Welcome to Fried, the Burnout Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Donovan, burnout expert, keynote speaker, and author focused on burnout as a match issue at work. Fried looks at burnout as information, not failure. When people, roles, expectations, leadership behaviors, and systems fall out of alignment, burnout is often the signal. Seasons 1 through 10 of Fried focus primarily on individual burnout and recovery, and those episodes are still available. You can use the Fried episode finder to find the conversations that best match what you're dealing with right now. Starting in season 11, the focus shifts to the workplace. The conversations center on how leaders and organizations can improve match and get rid of burnout in realistic, sustainable ways. I also work directly with companies and events through burnout and emotional intelligence keynotes, workshops, and longer-term advisory work. If burnout has been getting your attention, this podcast will help you understand what it's pointing to and how to find a better match.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.
All right, Fried fam, I am very excited today to introduce you to not only a good friend of mine, but someone who has created something that I honestly believe can change the business world and how we do a very particular thing that most leaders think is kind of bullshit. So we'll get into that in a minute. But today you get to hear from Mike Goldman, who is a leadership team coach, the author of 3 books, including the USA Today bestseller on multiple weeks.
Woohoo!
The Strength of Talent. He's a TEDx speaker and speaks internationally to groups of business leaders such as IBM, Allstate, the Young Presidents Organization, the Entrepreneurs Organization, Vistage International, and is it Tech Canada or TEC Canada?
Tech.
Tech Canada. Because there's no H at the end, so I didn't know.
No, and it's still, it is really TEC, but everybody says tech.
Okay, fair.
It does stand for something.
This is not a good thing to have in your bio. You should change it.
All right, let's cut. Let's stop. Do this all over again.
Nope, we're keeping it. He's also the host of the Better Leadership Team Show. During his 35 plus year coaching and consulting career, he has worked with clients including Disney, Verizon, Chanel, and Polo Ralph Lauren. You may have heard of one or two or all of those. His insights have been featured in Forbes, Fast Company, and Chief Executive Magazine, and he is widely regarded by CEOs as the expert on building great leadership teams. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's about time. You've been on my show twice. Now I'm finally on yours.
Listen, some of us have better things to share than others. Folks, and just so you know, Mike and I actually do spend quite a bit of time together. This might be a slightly more sarcastic episode than you're used to because that's just how we relate to one another. All right. First things first. I foreshadowed this not very well in the beginning, that I think that you have something that could literally change the way businesses run. And when I was reading your book, even though I had heard about it for the whole time you were writing it, we talked about it every month. You know, like I knew a lot about this book. And even still, when I read the book, and then I also listened to the podcast episodes you did on the Better Leadership Team Show about the book. And when I was listening to it, I got a little bit jealous. I'll tell you why. Because I thought, oh my God, he's actually figured out something that literally everyone needs. And he's done it in a way that is so accessible. And I like can't wait for this to blow up. So the thing that you are attempting to replace is the performance review. Can we talk about the performance review to kick us off? Because you've done a few conversations about this book. I don't want to say all the same things you've said on the other ones. We're going to do a little different. So we're just going to jump right into that.
Love it. Love it. And I'll start off by saying, and I'm going to answer the question about the performance review, because I love talking about that horrible, horrible thing. But the bigger umbrella is performance management is broken.
Yeah.
It was a study, the Mercer Group did a study and found that only 2% of leaders believe their performance management processes add significant value. And yet we keep doing the same things
Say
over
that
and
again.
Over again.
Can you give me that stat again?
Yeah, only 2% of leaders believe their performance management processes were adding significant value.
Folks, That means 98% do not think that the way that they are doing things now is adding significant value to the company.
And yet we keep banging our heads against the wall. So back to the annual performance review.
Yeah.
That is something I'm old. I'm turning 60. By the time you're listening to this, I will be 61. And so I've been around the block a few times, and annual performance reviews have been a thing since way before my time. I have clients that I begin my work with, and they're like, oh, we're so glad you're coming on board. We know you're all about people. In fact, you know, we're working right now to implement a new annual performance review. And I'm like, oh, I think I'm going to throw up. People think like there are companies that don't do it and they kick themselves for not doing it. And I believe annual performance reviews are the worst invention ever created in business. Now imagine this. So imagine you are coaching a sports team. It's basketball season right now as we're recording this. So I'm going to pick basketball. And imagine just ruined the whole thing. I'm a Knicks fan, by the way. So imagine you're a basketball coach and you've got somebody on your team that all year his shot is off or her shot is off. Defense is a step too slow, just having a really, really bad year. So of course, what I'm going to do is I'm going to wait until the end of basketball season to sit down with that person and let them know what they're doing wrong so they can do better next season. How does that sound as a good coach?
It sounds ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. And yet that's what we do. And on top of that, we add salt to the wound. And not now I'm sure people are having informal conversations throughout the year. I'm exaggerating slightly. But why wait until the end of the year to have the important conversation about what someone's doing well, what someone's doing not well, what someone's not doing well, what their goals should be for the upcoming year? And salt on the wound is there's two other things we do. One during the annual performance review, one may not be during, but it happens at the same time, is not only am I going to give you a performance review way too late in the game, but I'm also going to tell you what your rating is this year. Okay, this year you're a 3 out of 4. And you're sitting there thinking,
that's never happened.
Yeah, I kicked ass all year. I should have been a 4. And you're now feeling defensive that you should have been a 4 and I gave you 3. And there's another reason you're defensive other than you just think you're a lot better than I do. The other reason you're defensive is because you also know what happens around the same time of year.
Bonuses.
Salary adjustments and bonuses. So, of course, me giving you a 3 instead of a 4 is going to mean less money in your bank account. So instead of us, even with the horror of doing it once a year, and by the way, if you're listening and you're saying, that's why we do quarterly performance reviews, congratulations, you do a crappy process 4 times a year. But not only are we waiting too long to have the conversations, but then they become very defensive conversations because you're trying to defend your work versus us having a real conversation about performance. So, you know, I believe, and there's a whole process I recommend, which Kate, I'll leave up to you whether we dig in, but there is a specific process that I implement with my clients, which allows those conversations in a structured way to have those conversations happening throughout the year.
So when you first gave me that stat, or when I might have either, I don't know whether I saw it in the book first or I heard it on the podcast first, I thought to myself, 98% of people don't think that this is good, but we're still doing it. And mostly because we don't have another option. We don't have another option. I was just actually, we were watching the playoff games football last night. And who's the quarterback for the 49ers?
Purdy.
Nope. That's not the game that I was watching.
You're talking about the guy who played really bad or the guy that played really well? CJ Stroud.
Yeah. Stroud.
There you go.
So we were watching that game and I he was, you know, falling apart in the first half. And I said to my husband, oh, I hope like they can, I don't really care who wins that game because they're not my teams. But I said to my husband, oh, I hope they can like, they have somebody that can get to him in the half hour in between, because, you know, I'm a Patriots girl and you've seen Tom Brady have a really shitty first half of a game. And then the second half he comes out, he's a completely different person. Like you can see it on his face. You can see it the way he stands. He's totally left it behind. He's a different person. He's focused. He's ready to go. And I thought, you know, they can do that if they have the right person and if they know how to have the right conversations. And he came out in the second half and he looked worse than he did in the first half. And I thought, well, this is the same problem. Like you're saying, you can't wait until the end. You can't wait till the end of the season or the end of the year. You can't even wait till the end of the game.
You can't. And it's not only the assess performance piece of what we're talking about. The process really needs to start with, if you are a leader, you need to make sure that you are aligned with each of your direct reports as to what your expectations are for their performance. I can't tell you how many times I see individuals that are surprised when they hear they're not performing well, or frankly, the opposite, surprised that they are performing well. And one of the things that I've seen, and I repeat over and over to my clients, is unclear expectations lead to unacceptable results. Now, notice I didn't say unclear expectations lead to unclear results.
Or poor performance.
Yeah, they lead to unacceptable results because they're, you know, people, I am a firm believer that everyone's trying to do the best they can with the resources they have. I don't believe that they're, you know, leaders, you know, might on bad days look at their team and say, this one's lazy, this one's this. I don't believe anybody wakes up in the morning trying to figure out how they're going to screw things up. Everybody's trying to do the best they can. And when we aren't crystal clear about our expectations around results, around what productivity really means, around what culture fit and behaviors are important, when we are not crystal clear, we're starting off behind. We're just using football as an analogy. We're starting the first quarter already down 28-0.
Yeah.
When we don't start with expectations, and as simple as that sounds, that's a step most leaders miss.
This is something that hit me when you were talking about it, because, you know, I'm the president of the NSA New York City chapter this year, and I probably was not ready for it on some level, right? Like, it's not like this crazy, super important, very responsible role. It only lasts a year, and you've got to keep things rolling and then move on. But I am so self-driven and self-motivated, and I make my own internal rules for things that need to get done, and I pay attention to processes so I know that I know how things are supposed to work, that I didn't understand how unclear my expectations were for people until I kept getting more and more questions at our board meetings. And I was like, how have you not figured that out yet? Because not everybody's brain works like mine. And I think that this happens a lot in leadership. Because the people that get promoted are people that were good at their jobs and they were probably naturally able to like figure some stuff out, put some stuff together. Then they get promoted to a leadership position. They don't get clear training because we all know there's not enough leadership training in the workplace. And then they assume everybody else is like them.
Absolutely. And how do I want to explain this? So we all know, we have all heard companies over and over again say things like, people are our greatest asset. And it's such a hunk of crap.
Yeah.
Like it shouldn't be.
But it
is. Let me be clear about that. It shouldn't be a hunk of crap.
We want you to be telling the truth when you say that.
But it's a hunk of crap. If people were your greatest asset, then as a leader, your number one priority would be setting expectations for your people, assessing performance against those expectations, coaching and developing people, re-recruiting people. All of those things would be top priority, and they're not for most leaders. Not because most leaders are bad people.
No.
Not because most leaders don't know how to lead. I frankly, I coach a whole lot of people that are way smarter than I am.
Yeah.
So it's not that I've figured out some genius thing they haven't figured out. But reality is, as a leader, we are every day hit with 127 different priorities. And because of that, we have a tendency to look at our direct reports and do two things that are really, really big mistakes. One is we look at our best people, our highest performers, and we say, thank God I don't have to worry about them. And we say things to them like, keep up the good work. Now, that doesn't sound like a bad thing, and I'm going to come back to it. We also look at our low performers, and we're like, they're taking up too much of my time. I have to fix them. I have to fix my low performers. So think about the result of that, which is, hey, when I was a leader, I did a lot of the same stuff. But think about what happens. So you've got a high-performing individual who you leave alone. Thank God for Kate. She's great. I don't have to worry about her. I'm not challenging Kate to raise the bar. I'm not investing in coaching and mentoring her. I'm not re-recruiting her. I'm not getting her more exposure to the industry. I'm not doing career planning. I'm saying I'm going to focus on my problem children. I don't have to worry about Kate. Now, Kate's good at what she does. She's not going to go from high performing to low performing because I'm ignoring her. But Kate, if you're on my team and I ignore you, is your performance going to dip?
Of course.
I would say it will. In fact, I think that's being optimistic.
Yeah.
What I have seen, and I was part of this when I had a leader say to me, keep up the good work on an annual performance review. If your best people don't grow with you, they will grow with someone else.
Yeah.
Right? So not only might a high performer's performance dip, but they may go away and work for your competition. So think about what happens. I ignore my high performer, my high performing folks dip. What happens with my low performing folks if I work every day to coach and develop someone that is not a fit or doesn't have the capabilities within my organization? Yes, I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to strike it rich every once in a while, and someone's going to go from low performing to high performing. But more likely what's going to happen is I'm going to coach someone like crazy. It's going to be really frustrating for me and for them. Will their performance improve? Sure, it will.
Minimally.
Are they going to go from low to high performing? No, they're probably going to go from unacceptable to barely acceptable.
Yeah.
So now think of what I have.
High performer.
Yeah, I have lower high performing folks, higher low performing folks. Congratulations, I now have mediocrity.
Yeah.
I did all that work for mediocrity.
Yeah.
And the challenge is most leaders underinvest in their high performers and overinvest in their low performers. And they do that again, not because they're bad leaders or bad people. I could remember when I used to write annual performance reviews way back when I was working for somebody else, I actually had my easiest time writing annual performance reviews for my worst people. Yeah. Because if you were a low performer, all I had to do was pick, you know, what are the three most important of the 18 things this person's doing wrong? What are the three that I want them to work on? And let me help them work on it. I can do that. But now I've got Kate working for me, who is better and smarter than I am. How am I going to help her? I have no idea. So again, I'm going to focus on my low performing folks. So part of what I do in the book and in my coaching is help people figure out what should you be doing when you're spending all that time with your high performers? How should you be making the decision as to whether for your low performing folks, you should be coaching them up or do you need to coach them out?
Well, and you'd say often that there's this idea of, you know, like high productivity, high performance, which are different things, and culture fit, and sort of the interplay between those three things. And when I think it was when at your book launch date, when we were at Barnes and Noble's, and you talked about that part quite a bit, and it really sunk into me that day that I was like, that because the book that I'm writing now is all about match. And the thing that you were talking about that day was match, not just fit, because fit to me is like, you can have a pair of pants on and a shirt on that both fit, but they don't match. Like, it's not just fit. It goes a level beyond that. Can you talk about this interplay between productivity, performance, and culture fit?
Yeah, performance and productivity are two of these words that get used interchangeably. And I believe they're different things. In fact, you know, one of the tools that's out there around performance management is this thing called Nine Box that you might have heard of. And I think it's overly complicated. And the two axes on the Nine Box, and I'll share my two axes, are performance and potential. Mm. I look at that word performance, I'm like, what is it? What if someone is really productive, but they're hurting everybody else's performance with their behavior? Is that a high performer? You know, and this thing potential, like, doesn't everybody have potential? To me, that's an excuse just for people that haven't performed yet. Yeah. So to me, the word performance there are two axes to performance in what I call the talent density assessment framework. The two axes are productivity and culture fit. Now, productivity is not how long and hard someone is working. Someone may be working long and hard because they're not very productive. Productivity is about results. That's it. It's pretty, you know, as simple or complex as that is, productivity is about results. And then you look at culture fit. Culture fit at an umbrella level is this person who may be high or low in productivity, they may be getting results or not getting results. Culture fit says, what impact are they having on the people around them? Someone that's a high culture fit is going to make the people around them better.
All right, pause.
What's that?
Pause. I want everybody to stop and think about this for a second. He didn't say high culture fit is somebody who aligns with what the company thinks, says, feels, and does. He did not say that. Can you say it again? What is culture fit?
So culture fit at the highest, most important level is a measure of the impact people have on the folks around them. They are a high culture fit if they are making the people around them better. They're a low culture fit if they're making the people around them worse. Now, they're also some companies do this well, some companies don't. There may be a set of core values that go along with it that are non-negotiable behaviors that make up culture fit. But to your point, the right core values is not everybody thinks alike. That means you all have the same blind spots. You're all going to make the same mistakes.
Yeah.
But we need folks that are both highly productive and high in culture fit. And I have people say to me, all right, Mike, but what do you do about the high performing jerk?
You can say asshole on this show.
I could, but that's question again. What do you do about the high performing jerk? We could say asshole if it sounds better. We're from New Jersey. We can say that. Now, in my, and I get the question, but there's two things wrong with that question. One is, if someone is not a culture fit, that doesn't mean they're a jerk. It just means, now it might, but more, I think a more productive way to think about it is they're just not a fit for our organization. They're not a match for what we need, to use your word. You know, it doesn't mean they're a bad person. Maybe teamwork is something and collaboration is something that is just, it's just a non-negotiable part of who we are. And we've got someone who is just crazy smart, but they want to be in the corner by themselves curing cancer because that's the way they work best, there may be a great environment for them. Yeah. But we're not a great environment. So two problems with that high performing asshole, you know, question. One is just because you're not living the culture doesn't mean you're a jerk or an ass. The other is, in my model, it's impossible to be a high performing jerk because performance does not equal productivity. You could be a highly productive jerk, but performance is both culture fit and productivity. And in my model, even if you are highly productive, if you're a bad culture fit, you're what I call a low culture fit team member, and you either need to be coached up or out. It's not, we're going to deal with your bad behavior that's hurting everybody else because you're our best salesperson. No, that's not good enough. You need to be living our culture.
So I just heard some people say, yeah, but if we lose our best salesperson, then, you know, we're going to lose 50% of our sales every year. We can't do that.
That conversation comes up, as you can imagine, all the time. And in fact, a quick story. I was working with a software company and they have their set of core values, and we were doing the talent assessment using this model. And by the way, this model we're talking about, I do quarterly with all my clients. We have a quarterly talent assessment and we're making decisions on performance and actions we should be taking and holding folks accountable. It's called the quarterly talent assessment meeting. And their number two salesperson, if it was number one, it would have been a better story, but I'm going to be honest, it was their number two. But they did have 35 salespeople. So number two is
so it wasn't two out of two.
Right. One, two out of two. Thank you. So their number two salesperson was being assessed, and the VP of sales was saying, you know, really good at selling, but very disrespectful to the customer service team, not collaborative with the other salespeople, always very pessimistic. And the CEO jumps in and says, hold on, I know where this is leading. And Mike, I know you're going to ask the question, are we coaching up or coaching out? But I am telling you right now that I am not even having this conversation with my number two salesperson. We need the revenue. Let's move on. There was silence in the room. And I said, and the rest of the team was kind of afraid to say something. This is the leaders in the room. And I said, okay. I said, I get it. I'm not going to argue. But what I am going to coach you to do is all of those core values posters you have all over the office and all the bling you have with the core values on it and website and everything else, my recommendation is please get rid of all that stuff.
Yeah.
Because if you allow your highly productive team members to be a bad culture fit, to hurt the people around them, but your lower productive, your people lower in productivity, those folks are going to wind up getting fired for not living the culture, then your core values and everything you say about your culture just becomes a hammer you use to hit low productivity people. Now, with that, the rest of the leadership team jumped in and basically attacked the CEO and said, we've got to think about it differently. The CEO backed off. They made the decision to give that person one more chance, and then they wound up coaching him out of the organization. And yes, they coached out the number two salesperson, but everybody else's productivity around them jumped up, including folks not even in sales, and they all looked at each other and said, why didn't we do this a year ago?
Yeah. So folks, for those of you who don't know, in the world of burnout, there are six workplace factors that can create a vulnerability to workout in your workers. One of the top six is a mismatch of values. And that mismatch of values is not necessarily between you and the person working for you, but it can be between, and the most common problem I see in the values world is between the values you assert and the values you act. as a company, as an organization. So the idea, this idea that you'd have to pull them off the wall, this appeals to me because it's very clear in all the research that if a company does not act its chosen values, then the vulnerability to burnout goes up drastically across the entire company from janitor to CEO. Every single position is at risk because you as a company are not living according to your own values that you chose in a board meeting 2 years ago.
And by the way, when I say they decided to fire this person and everybody else's product, like to me, that's only a partial happy ending to the story. I don't think the story has a happy ending. Because, and in fact, I know because I worked with them for a while after this. Think about the impact that CEO had on the rest of the leadership team in that moment. Because to your point, those, that culture that they thought they were trying to create, those non-negotiable core values that they all thought they had aligned on, they all realized in that moment to the CEO, those were just words. But at the end of the day, if someone was bringing in the revenue, those words mattered less. That mismatch.
Yeah, exactly.
And this story I'm telling you is about a five-year-old story. It still impacts their culture today. Because it takes years to build a culture. You can tear it down in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it becomes super, super important. And by the way, when there is a true mismatch of values or a mismatch of capabilities, the one of the big mistakes I see, I mentioned one big mistake is people kind of, you know, underinvest in their highest performers. The other big mistake I see that gets back to this idea of the mismatch is we keep low performing folks. And by low performing, I either mean they're low in productivity and or they're low in culture fit. Could be either one of those. Leaders keep those low performing folks around way too long. I get involved and I'm like, well, how long has this been going on? Oh, like a year and a half. Like, that's leadership malpractice. What do you mean it's been going on a year and a half? And one of the biggest reasons why that happens, other than a fear of having the difficult conversation and a fear of being short-staffed when I lose this person. Sure. Those are all real. But the other thing that happens is we hang on to people out of a misplaced sense of loyalty to them. So here's what I mean by that. We think we're being good human beings by saying, I'm going to give them another chance. I'm going to give them another chance. I'm going to give them another chance. And part of the reason why I don't think that makes us a good human being is because every chance you're giving them, they're hurting the company. They're hurting your team. They're hurting you. They're hurting your clients.
And they're not helping themselves either.
That's the key. What you just said. Now I want to dig into that because that's absolutely where I was going, where I'm going, Kate, is, you know, when I get out and I do my keynotes or my workshops, I go through all of these concepts and then I put a slide up there and I say, everyone has the ability to be a superstar. I say, everyone can be a superstar. And I look at the audience and I say, how many of you believe this? And at that moment, I know I've just lost half the audience who's saying, you know, I trusted this little guy from Jersey until now, but come on, this is bullshit. Like everybody, like what planet are we living on that everybody could be a superstar? But then I hit my clicker and I go to the next part of the slide and the word somewhere comes up. So now it says everyone can be a superstar somewhere.
Yeah.
And people go, oh. And I believe that not only as a leader, I believe it as a father. Yeah. So, Kate, you know my son, who's now 31 years old, I have a son with Asperger's syndrome. And for those that don't know what that is, it's on the autism spectrum. So I can remember years ago, I saw a story that one of the high-tech companies was hiring only autistic adults to do all of their system testing, to test their code. Because those folks, way more than any of us, unless any of you listening are on the spectrum, those folks had an unbelievable ability to hyper-focus on the same thing over and over again and look for small changes. So you take that and you realize that when we hang on to people that don't have the capability to do what we need them to do, or it's a mismatch in values, we're actually holding them back from going somewhere where they can excel. Now, I'm not suggesting when we fire them, they're going to thank us for it. But I do think for a lot of people, a year later, 2 years later, and I've seen it, they will thank us for it.
Yeah.
Because we free them up to go do something where they could actually do a great job. Trust me, if it's as upset and unhappy and frustrated as you are with their performance, they're not feeling any better than you do.
Yeah.
So why are we holding on to them when we're not only hurting us and our team, but we're hurting them?
And I read something recently, and you said the word potential earlier, that a company was using that as one of their metrics. And I thought, gosh, what a terrible metric to use. That's a terrible metric. And it's actually, there was a study done that shows that the potential we see in other people is a direct reflection of the potential we believe that we have in their situation. It actually doesn't have anything to do with them. So when we're talking about potential, we are all talking about ourselves, which is like so messed up. But that also means that if you're using potential as a metric and you have somebody that really strongly believes in their own capacity and capabilities, they're going to see everyone as like having, yeah, right? Like as having this super high potential. I remember one of my best friends and his boyfriend broke up. This was probably a decade ago. And we were having all these conversations and he kept talking about, yeah, but his potential. And I stopped and I was like, babe, you can't stay with somebody for the person that they are not yet. And he looked at me and we both like stopped for a second and he was like, oh shit, he's never going to get there, is he? And I was like, no.
It's a great way to think of it. You almost think like, imagine, you know, someone's about to get married and it's like, yeah. Oh, so isn't that great? So why are you marrying him? Because I think he's got great potential. Like immediately your mind would go, oh shit, you're in trouble.
Exactly. Right. Like
I'm marrying him because I think I can change him into the person he needs to be. Oh my
gross.
God. And
that's
by the way, let me be clear.
I
believe everyone has potential.
So the same as the superpower thing, though.
This one has more potential. This one has less potential. Now, I think there is a very important place for that kind of conversation. When I am working with my leadership teams on assessing performance of folks, and we're looking on it, not on potential, but on productivity and on culture fit, there are folks that we look at and we say, okay, of these next direct reports, Who here do we think has the highest potential to be sitting around this leadership team table a year from now? Like there are folks that you look at and say they have shown a great potential in this area, and therefore I'm going to work with them a little bit more to get them here. But we're not measuring potential on a scale of 1 to 10. No. It's not one of the major measures. It's productivity and culture fit. Potential is still an interesting, sometimes important conversation to have, but I think everyone's got potential. And if you've got someone who's underperforming for 6, 9, 12 months, and you're still saying, yeah, but they've got potential, you're just making an excuse for someone who's not performing yet.
Yeah. Well, and I think when we're using potential the way that you were saying just now, like I see that this person has shown blah, 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 I don't think we're talking about potential there. I think what we're saying is these are the skills that are needed to be good at this job. This person already has these skills and therefore could be good at this job.
That's a great
point.
That's
not potential. That's skill assessment.
Great point. I agree 1,000%.
Right? All right. So let's get into the talent density system for a minute. We already started with step one, set expectations. You said that in the beginning. And then we've been talking about now step two, assess performance. So step one, set expectations. Step two, assess performance. Step three.
Step three is action.
Which means?
Who gives a rip about our assessment of performance unless we're taking action on it? Mm. Right. So so in this, I mentioned something called the quarterly talent assessment meeting earlier. In that quarterly talent assessment meeting, that leadership team is not only assessing performance together And I hesitate on the word together or highlight that word together, because doing it together is the truth serum. You can't come in and say, all of my, you know, all of my salespeople are high performing when you haven't hit a sales quota as a company in the last 5 quarters. So there's a truth serum of everybody getting together and sharing and challenging each other. But the other part of getting those leaders together is aligning around what are the actions we should be taking. There is a very specific prescribed set of actions to take with your highest performing team members, whether it is challenging them, raising the bar, giving them more responsibility, career planning, re-recruiting. There's a whole set of actions to have. What should we be doing with our medium performers? Who can be coached up? Where do we need to change a role? Do we have places in our organization where good enough isn't good enough? And even though they are mediocre performers, maybe they need to be coached out of the organization. What action should we be taking with our low performing folks? The actions for low culture fit folks are very different than the actions for your low end productivity folks. Mm-hmm. And frankly, your probability of success is very different. If someone is a great fit for your culture, but they're low in productivity, they tend at some level to be coachable.
Yeah.
Right? Coachable to get where you need them to go? I don't know. They may or may not have the capability, but at some level, they're coachable. But someone who is not living your non-negotiable core values, trying to coach them to live your core values is like trying to coax someone to become someone they're not.
Well,
and if you put them on a 90-day performance improvement plan with job-threatening consequences, they could fake it for 90 days, and then they're going to go back to who they really are, which is not a bad person, but it's a bad fit. So this action piece is of all these things, the most important piece. If you're not taking action, none of the rest of it matters. But this is where, you know, I said earlier, the number one driver of profit growth is people growth. And that as a leader, your number one priority should be taking action with you. Number one priority should be growing your people. This is where it all happens. If you're not consistently taking action, coaching, developing, coaching up, coaching out, then you're not going to get where you need to go, and you're not going to have the right team around you.
Yeah. And I think this point about the low culture fit person being likely less coachable because it's just a fit and a lack of match. A lack of fit is just a lack of match, a lack of fit. It doesn't have to have any morality attached to it, like you were saying earlier. And to me, we go back to this point about a culture fit being someone who positively impacts the people around them and doesn't negatively impact the people around them. So having somebody that's a low culture fit that negatively impacts the people around them, just the act of not acting on that person throws morale into the toilet.
And your highest performers say, why am I working so hard?
Right. Every single person that I've spoken to that's been through burnout has had somebody in their company like this that their company refused to move. And that destroyed the morale and the feelings and the desire and the drive and the engagement for the whole damn team because they were a bad fit.
Yeah. The other thing that becomes important, and it gets to the next step, the fourth step, which is accountability. And accountability includes a lot of things, but I'm going to focus on one, which is measurement. So think about that statement I've said a couple times now. The number one driver of profit growth is people growth. People nod their head. That makes sense. I agree with that. But the problem with it is there's this cliche that you can't manage what you don't measure. And I think it's a cliche because it's true a lot of the time. Well, do we measure profit growth?
Of course.
Of course we do. I ask a leader, they know to the 10th of a percent how they're doing compared to last year, how they're doing compared to plan. But then I say, how are you doing on people growth? And I get answers like, oh, we're pretty good. We're almost caught up in our annual performance reviews. There's no measure there. And I'm interested how you think this might affect burnout. The fact that, you know, to me, a measure tells us whether we're winning the race. Yeah. It tells us where the finish line is. And if we feel like we're working hard and we're working hard and we're working harder and we're working harder and we're not sure whether we're getting anywhere close to where we need to be, that can't be good for us mentally. So the idea of having a measure, and I've created a measure called the Talent Density Indicator. And it's very simple, but incredibly powerful one, where in my framework, and we've kind of alluded to this, there are four different levels of performance. If you're high in both culture fit and productivity, you're high performing. If you are low in culture fit, you're low culture fit. If you're very low in productivity, you're low producing. And if you're not high enough to be high performing or low enough to be in one of those two low performing categories, you're medium performing. It's not rocket science. But this idea of the TDI, the Talent Density Indicator, is a calculation that says of the folks you're on your team, what percent, the percent high performing minus the percent low performing. And if you think about that math, that number can go anywhere from negative 100% if you have all low performing individuals on your team to positive 100% if you have all high performing, and obviously anywhere in the middle. We use that measure as a benchmark. We could benchmark the company, levels of the leadership team, sales versus marketing, you know, the TDI for a leader, but now you've got a benchmark. And you could say, okay, all these actions I need to take are to improve that number. And as the number goes up or the number goes down, we try to understand why it's happening and what we need to do differently. And it gives us not only a way to hold each other accountable, but a way for all of us to have some sense, again, whether we're winning or losing the race or whether we're just working really hard every day and not really knowing how we're doing.
And this is my favorite part. This is the genius piece that I think is like so dang useful. And one of the reasons that I explicitly love this system is because it's a measure of the company as a whole. Each person has to be measured and scaled out, right? Like, so yeah, high performer, high, low performer this way, you know, low producing, whatever, low culture fit, blah, blah, blah. But the number is for the company, which means that it can't be weaponized against people. So I think a lot of times, like I was thinking about creating a burnout assessment in a company, and every time I was creating it, and I've over the past 10 years, I've tried to do this like 8 times, and I've used AI and I've not used AI, and I've talked to college professors, and I've tried this a million ways, but every time I do it, I come to this place where I think, yeah, but this ends up being about the individual, and this can be used against the individual. This system, when you're talking about the talent density indicator overall for a company, is not about an individual. Yes, you might need to coach out some low performers. That you might need to coach out some low culture fits. Absolutely. However, it's not a, oh, you're dangerous for us because you don't handle stress well, so we got to get rid of you. It's like, no, you're not a fit for us for all of these reasons, and this makes more sense. So to me, it's like it's an honest but gentle and company level number that the company can look at as a whole all together is what makes it so impactful, I think.
It is, and you'll tell me whether this and is going to contradict what you said about being able to weaponize it. And I'm interested in your thoughts on it. It's a company level number, but I also recommend that each leader is accountable for the TDI on their team.
Of their team, sure.
Company level number, but I believe one of the key performance indicators, and I talk about leading and lagging indicators. A lagging indicator is the measure of a result.
Yeah.
So anything on the P&L is a result, revenue, profitability, gross margin, blah, blah, blah. A leading indicator is the measure of an activity that drives a result. I believe the TDI is the mother of all leading indicators, because if you drive people growth, you're going to see profit growth, you're going to see the results. And I do think each leader should be measured on the TDI of their team, not the absolute number necessarily. But if you're a leader on my team, I want to see that you're trending, for the most part, that your TDI is trending up.
Yeah.
Now, I say for the most part, because what happens is when you get a lot of high performing folks, you may challenge them and raise the bar, sure, and your TDI may go down slightly because you're raising the bar, and that's good. So I don't think that's what you mean by weaponizing it, but it's a number that you could look at by leader, by function, by level of an organization to hold everyone accountable,
yeah,
for growing their people.
But it's a way that everybody can understand, and it's not based on like your design as a person necessarily. Like low culture fit is about who you are, but like, you know that you're a low culture fit too. It's not a secret. And if everybody knows this language and everybody knows what we're looking for, then it becomes a really fair assessment overall. And I think in the world of mental health with burnout and how resilient somebody is in certain circumstances and how many resources they need, and that is really easy to weaponize. My stuff. Your stuff is not so easy to weaponize, especially if everyone knows. And then we're back to, we haven't gotten to step five, but we're back to set expectations when we're in the accountability section. Like those things wrap back around. And if everybody knows what the expectations are and everybody knows what the language is, it just becomes fact instead. There's no opinion in it, I guess, is the point. It's just, this is where you are based on the measurement.
Yeah, part of what helps it become fact is absolutely, it starts with having expectations versus, yeah, just, I think they're highly productive. No, how are they doing against, right, their productivity measures? But the fact that the leaders do this assessment together,
yeah,
and can call bullshit on each other. And it's not just calling bullshit. What you see very often is, you know, you've got members of your team, especially around culture fit. Productivity is a fact.
Yeah.
You know, it's results. But culture fit is, while I try to make it more science than art and make it more factual, hey, culture fit is going to be at some level qualitative. But what makes it more fact-based is having those other members of the team,
yeah,
that could not only call bullshit, because that assumes you're not telling the truth, but they help you because your team members, when you're the leader, they probably treat you pretty well. What you don't see is how they treat other people. So having the rest of the leadership team in the room that says, well, yeah, you're their boss, so of course they're optimistic with you and they're collaborative with you. But let me tell you what it looks like when they work with the operations team, because it ain't that pretty.
Yeah.
That kind of accountability and you know, making that assessment more accurate versus just being weaponized or all, yeah, qualitative makes it a lot more useful.
Well, and I think the idea of like, is this person in general helping everybody around them be better or not is pretty clear. But
you will have different opinions on that.
Yeah.
Right. Someone who is, you know, someone could say, well, this person is rude. And there's no tact, and they're disrespectful.
Stop
and,
talking
and,
about me.
And,
just kidding.
And someone else might say, I love how direct and to the point they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's where, you know, it's not like, you know, their sales,
well, there's gotta
number
be a
was
consensus.
X versus Y.
Yeah. But there's a consensus.
Yeah.
Typically, an overall consensus. And I think that's important. So we have set expectations, assess performance, act to drive accountability. Step five, we're going slightly over time, but we're just going to go with it. Unless you have a
step
call
five,
at 4 o'clock.
Step five. No. Oh my God, I got to go. Bye. Step five is cascading this whole process down through the organization. And, you know, when I do this, I always start this whole process with the senior leadership team and only the senior leadership team, which means that the senior leaders are assessing performance of their direct reports one level down. Now, the reason why this cascade became a fifth step is because I've seen it really screwed up. And here's what could happen. The good news is I have leadership teams. They fall in love with this process. This is amazing. We've never accurately assessed people like this. We're taking better action. We see better performance. We're having these great conversations with each other, all that stuff. Therefore, let's do this down throughout the entire organization. Let's go from not just to C-level, all of us C-level folks, let's drive it down to VPs and drive it down to managers and supervisors. And, you know, that sounds great. They love my process and they want to do that. Here's the problem with it. It takes a level of leadership maturity to do this in an open, honest, vulnerable way. It takes some real forethought, proactivity to communicate what you're doing in the right way. So here are two different alternative whispers in the hallway about this process. The first whisper in the hallway is, hey, could you believe what I found out? You know, our leaders, they get together once a quarter to figure out who they're going to fire. Could you believe the company we work for?
This is the fear of weaponization.
Here's the second whisper in the hallway. You know what I just found out? Do you know that our leaders get together once a quarter and spend time for the sole purpose of figuring out how they could help all of us? Now, by the way, let's be real. Both of those whispers are true at some level.
Yeah, of course.
But if you don't, if you don't cascade this down in the right way, and in my book, I talk about a lot of different kind of change management techniques to make sure this is communicated in the right way, and you're training people on how to do this in the right way, that you are helping people understand that this is not a time for them to be defensive about their team. Because by the way, if as a leader, they're not hitting their KPIs, but they believe everyone on their team is great, then who's the problem?
Yeah.
The problem's the leader. So like you're not helping anybody by protecting your people. What you're doing is you're taking the bullet for everybody else. We can do better than that. So the idea of starting this as a senior leadership team first, it takes a while to get good at this and be open and honest about it. Do it for two or three quarters. Get it right first, and then very purposefully cascade this down through the organization. That's an important piece of this whole puzzle.
And then it just starts over again. It loops right back around. Set expectations.
Absolutely.
It
never ends. You're always, you know, I hope you, I pray for your success that you are resetting expectations fairly often.
Yeah. And raising especially
the
now
bar fairly often.
Right. Especially now, what the rate of change for businesses now is something like 12 to 18 months, if not faster. It's like, you don't have time to not be reassessing and setting expectations. You don't have time anymore. This is not 1975 where you had 20, 30 years where you could just sort of chill and do the same thing over and over again. Like, those times are gone.
Well, I'm going to push back a little being the old guy in the room. People always, things are changing. You know what? Things were changing really fast. You know, I started my career in 1987. Things are always changing fast.
I was five.
Today, yeah. Could I say, could I, is this on video? Are they seeing which finger I have up?
Well, that rate of change shift comes from Nadia. You know Nadia Zaksambayeva?
Yes, yes.
So that's her research, her PhD research. And she does change management all over the world. And the rate of change has shifted from something like a 25-year scale to a 12 to 18-month scale.
Wow.
From that time until now. Like, we literally are changing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times faster than we ever did before.
From the beginning of this podcast to the end, I wonder what's changed. My God.
So much. Folks, this is Mike Goldman. The Strength of Talent is his book, The Talent Density Assessment Indicator.
Something like that.
All those things. That's what he does. I think that, A, you should read the book. And the book has its own website. You can go to MikeGoldman.com, but you can also go to strengthoftalent.com.
Mike-Goldman.com.
Mike-Goldman. But you can just go to Strength of Talent.
I lost Mike Goldman to some guy who was on the Big Brother show in Australia. He's got MikeGoldman.com, so I had to get Mike-Goldman.com.
So rude. But you could also go to strengthoftalent.com. And I have seen Mike speak in front of various size audiences. He's got something that grabs people. He's got the right charisma. He's got the right rhythm. He's got the right context. He knows how to, he's great at Q&A. So if you're looking for a keynote speaker, or you need books for your organization, or you need somebody to come in and do this work, I very highly recommend my friend Mike. Mike, do you have any parting words?
This was fun. And to every leader out there, make developing your people your number one priority. You will not be sorry you did.
Amen. All right, Fried Fam. Until next time.
Welcome to Fried, the Burnout Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Donovan, burnout expert, keynote speaker, and author focused on burnout as a match issue at work. Fried looks at burnout as information, not failure. When people, roles, expectations, leadership behaviors, and systems fall out of alignment, burnout is often the signal. Seasons 1 through 10 of Fried focus primarily on individual burnout and recovery, and those episodes are still available. You can use the Fried episode finder to find the conversations that best match what you're dealing with right now. Starting in season 11, the focus shifts to the workplace. The conversations center on how leaders and organizations can improve match and get rid of burnout in realistic, sustainable ways. I also work directly with companies and events through burnout and emotional intelligence keynotes, workshops, and longer-term advisory work. If burnout has been getting your attention, this podcast will help you understand what it's pointing to and how to find a better match.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.